Anyone? Anyone at all? It's okay. I had to look it up too. No, we got up to Ruth. We got up to the story of Ruth. And then we jumped for Lent. We jumped into the Gospels, and then we worked through Acts. And so we're jumping back into the Old Testament after a bit of a hiatus. And today we are going back to the books of 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings. As I've done with a lot of the other books and a lot of the other passages, I want to give you something helpful for you as you read the books, because we can't cover everything that's in them. So I want to give you something helpful to you as you read them, and then explore one passage from within them. The books of 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings, they really tell kind of one continuing story. In fact, in some collections of the writing, in particular the Septuagint, which was around a couple hundred years before Jesus, they actually kind of had them all as like book one, book two, book three, book four, as one continuing story. It starts with Samuel, the prophet, priest, judge, and he's used by God and by Israel to initiate the kingship, first with Saul, and then through the line of David. And the rest of the story tracks with the lines of kings, their interactions with different prophets, and the struggles of the people of Israel to be faithful as God's people. These books are often considered historical or history books, and they certainly, when you read them, they read like records of history. You know, this thing happened, and then this king did this, and then this happened, and then the prophet came and said this, and it sounds like a history record of sorts. But it's important to understand that ancient books that look like history are not—they weren't written with the same things in mind as a contemporary book that's written as history. I think most of us in today's day and age, you know that if you watch a movie that's historical, or you read a book that's historical, most of the time, the author is trying to do more than just communicate history, right? I think we've kind of moved far enough in our view of documentaries that we know that there is an agenda when a record of history is being shared. Is that fair to say that we would tend to agree with that? The same was true with historical things back then, but in even more profound a way, because even in today's day and age, if someone writes a history with an agenda and the facts aren't accurate, then someone's going to jump all over that and criticize it, and there's going to be lots of interaction about how you can't believe a word that's said because they totally messed up the history. They didn't quite have that same opportunity when they're writing histories back in the ancient world. Ancient books that look like history aren't really meant to give an accurate record of events at that time. They aren't objective books at all. Scholars Andrew Hill and John Walton describe ancient Near Eastern history kinds of books. They describe it as propaganda clothed in historical attire with the purpose of benefiting those in power. Kings would have these stories written to boast of their accomplishments, embellishing the positive, ignoring the negative, and at times taking credit for the achievements of his predecessor. I'm glad that never happens with leaders today. They go on to say, when the purpose is self-aggrandizement and the rewards are power and prestige, accuracy becomes of little concern. That's not to say in ancient Near Eastern history that there wasn't ever accuracy. That just wasn't the purpose of the book. The purpose of writing in ancient Near Eastern history stuff was to make the king look good, to tell everybody how awesome the king was, and to have everyone, basically he's telling his story so that everyone will like him. When we get to the histories of the Bible, these historical books, it's important to keep that in mind, that we read it in light of how they were written back then, not how we expect it to be written today. But there's a big key difference. Where most literature similar to this in the ancient Near East was written to paint a portrait of the king, these writings actually reflect really badly on the kings. If you read through 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, the kings rarely come out looking particularly good. These stories weren't written to build up the king. They were written to build up God. They were written to give us a perspective on God and what he's up to in the world, often at often in spite of the tragic actions of the king. Again, Hill and Walton, who have written excellent commentaries on this stuff, they say Israel's God in these passages is revealed as one who has a plan for history and who intervenes to ensure that plan is executed. Well, Israel's neighbors believed that their gods at times intervened in history to just keep the status quo. The God of Israel intervened at times to work towards a goal that had never yet been achieved. All God's intervention is focused towards a single goal, the execution of this plan that he has in mind. And so I am not saying that these are not historically true, but what I am saying is if we read it to learn history, we're not reading for the primary purpose it's intended for. It's written to tell us the story of how God is at work in the world, moving things towards the end that he wants. It ultimately is pointing towards Jesus. At the end of the day, here's three tips from Hill and Walton that they give for reading historical literature. With these three things, it'll help you kind of read the stories of these books. And then after I share that, we'll jump into one specific story. They say this. They say, first of all, think of the books as theological rather than historical. So you're reading it to see God at work and discover God in these stories, not primarily to read history. Even if there may be a time, if somebody could come up and say, look, we've got this archaeological evidence that says it didn't happen that way, we can say, okay, that's not the primary purpose of the book. It's primarily trying to point us to God. And they're teaching something that's important and true about God that we hold on to. The second thing is that we need to remember that the main focus of the literature is God and his covenant, not people and events. And we can sometimes read these stories and get caught up in this person and that person and the other person, thinking it's telling their story. It's not primarily telling David's story or Solomon's story or any of the other king's stories or even Samuel's story. It's telling God's story. It's about him and his covenant. God's doing something bigger than any one person or any one circumstance or any one story. The third thing to remember is that historical cause and effect is seen largely in terms of the role of God rather than the actions of his people. It's exploring God's place in history more than it's exploring humanity's place in history. That doesn't mean that people don't have a major role to play. It doesn't mean that people don't have a significant role to play in shaping history. That's just not what these books are emphasizing. These books are emphasizing God's role. That's the purpose of the exploration of the book. So we're going to jump into one of the stories. It's one that I find really, really fascinating. Many of you, if you've been in church for a long period of time, will have heard this story. And so what I'm going to talk about is probably not new to many of you, but it's just so fun. It's such a great story in here and what it helps us to see about God that we're going to go there anyway. If you want to turn in your Bibles, we're going to be tracking through 1 Kings, really 16, 17, 18. This is a story of a prophet named Elijah, a king named Ahab, and his wife Jezebel. And we're just going to talk about some of that story and wrestle with, okay, where is God? What is God showing and doing in this passage? The background: Ahab was the king. And Ahab was a king who was not faithful to God. He married a woman named Jezebel, who is especially not faithful to God. And 1 Kings 16, verse 30, describes Ahab with these very complimentary words. He said, Ahab did more evil in the eyes of the Lord than any of those before him. And if you read the stories of those before him, they did some pretty bad stuff. And yet Ahab did more evil than any of those before him. Elijah, a prophet of Yahweh. So when I talk about Yahweh today, I'm talking about the God of Israel, that's the personal name of God that's given. And it's important to have that name because in this story, there's a conflict between gods, and it's Yahweh versus Baal. Okay, and so rather than just saying God all the time, I will sometimes be saying Yahweh. That's what I'm talking about. Elijah, a prophet of Yahweh, in contrast to those who are prophets of Baal, he comes onto the scene in 1 Kings chapter 17, and his first exchange with Ahab begins with him telling Ahab that there's not going to be any rain for a few years and that it won't rain again until he, Elijah, says so. The rest of chapter 17 describes how God provided for Elijah through the famine that came and how his ministry was affirmed through some miraculous events. He gets fed where there seems to be no food. He raises someone back from the dead. It's some really amazing things that happen. But as they get into the third year of the famine, God shows up to Elijah and tells him that he's going to send rain again. That's the beginning of chapter 18. The word of the Lord came to Elijah, "Go and present yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain on the land." So Elijah went to present himself to Ahab. As the story moves on, we start to find out some of the things that have happened during the couple of years of famine. Elijah goes to find Ahab, and instead he finds Obadiah, who is King Ahab's right-hand man. As evil as King Ahab is, Obadiah has been faithful to Yahweh. Through the exchange with Obadiah and Elijah, we find out some of what's happened over the last couple of years. One of the things that happened was that Ahab, under Jezebel's influence, has sought to kill off anyone who has spoken for God. He has set out anybody who would be considered a prophet of Yahweh. Ahab's tried to kill them. Obadiah rescued 150 of these prophets and hid them in a cave and gave them food, but he got in trouble for it. Ahab has also spent considerable time and effort hunting for Elijah and hasn't been able to find him. Every time they thought they found him, he wouldn't be there. So Ahab is just frustrated and things. Every time that happened, he would get angry. And so Elijah connects with Obadiah and says that he says, "Hey, go tell Ahab I'm going to see him." And Obadiah is actually scared for his life. So you think I'm crazy? I've already gotten trouble from my king for protecting the 150 prophets. And now you're going to come and tell me that I'm going to appear before the king. And just like every other time, we're going to get to where you're supposed to be. And you're not going to show up. And he's going to have my head because he's so sick of this game of hide and seek that you're playing. And so Obadiah is upset. But Elijah promises him he is going to see the king today. Sure enough, Obadiah arranges the meeting, and Elijah appears before the king. Ahab is angry. He's like, "Look what you've done to us. We haven't had rain for like 2.5 years, and it's your fault." And Elijah says, "No, actually, it's your fault because you're the one that's not following God. It's not my fault." And then Elijah says, "Tell you what, we'll do a showdown. You go get your 450 prophets of Baal," and Baal was a Canaanite god of that day. It says, "And go get the 400 prophets of Asherah," that was a goddess of that day, "and we'll go meet at Mount Carmel." Lots of significant stuff happened at Mount Carmel. It said, "We'll meet there." And so he says, "Okay." So they go and they meet there, and all kinds of people obviously find out this is happening. They come to watch this whatever is going to happen. And when they get there, Elijah issues a public challenge. He asks the people of Israel, says, "Okay, who are you going to trust in? Are you going to trust in Baal or Yahweh?" And they kind of look at the ground and he says, "Okay, tell you what we're going to do. If you think it'll be worth it, we will set up two altars. There's going to be the altar to the prophet of Baal. And they will build the altar. They will kill the bull on the altar. And there will be the altar that's sacrificing to Yahweh. And we will build the altar and we'll put the bull on the altar. And then we will pray. And whoever is God sends fire down from heaven first to burn up the sacrifice, that's whose God you will know is real. And we'll follow that God." And they say, "Cool, sounds like a good idea." So they do this. They set up, Elijah says, "Okay, there's 450 of you, you go first." So they build the altar, they kill the bull on the altar, and these 450 prophets of Baal begin to pray of sorts. They actually start dancing and chanting and calling on their God to send fire from heaven. 1 Kings 18, 26 to 29 describes the scene. So it says, they called on the name of Baal from morning till noon. "Baal, answer us," they shouted. Morning till noon, there's no response. No one answered. They danced around the altar they'd made. At noon, Elijah began to taunt them. "Shout louder," he said. "Surely he's a god, or perhaps he's deep in thought, or busy, or traveling. Maybe he's sleeping and you need to wake him up." So they shouted louder and slashed themselves with swords and spears, as was their custom. until their blood flowed. Midday passed, and they continued their frantic prophesying until the time of the evening sacrifice, but there was no response. No one answered. No one paid attention. Screaming, crying out, cutting themselves, Elijah mocking them the whole time, and nothing is happening. Elijah then calls the people over to his altar. And I think for dramatic effect, he has some people dig around the altar a trench. And then he calls on people to bring big jugs of water. Four of them, and they dump them over the altar, over the bowl, over everything. He says, go fill them up again. They do that two more times. So 12 giant things of water poured over it. So the whole thing is soaking wet, water dripping down, the trench is full of water. Then he gets down and prays. He prays that God would show that he is the real God. That's in chapter 18, verse 36 it starts. It says, Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, let it be known today that you are God in Israel and that I am your servant and have done all of these things at your command. Answer me, Lord, answer me so these people will know that you, Lord, are God and you are turning their hearts back again. He prays that. Fire comes down, burns up the sacrifice, burns up the stones, burns up all the woods, the soil, water's all gone, just burns it all up. Everything is gone. Elijah seizes the opportunity and this excitement and the fervor over, wow, look what God did, look what Yahweh did, to make a bold statement, and he has the people grab the 450 prophets of Baal and kill them all. Only then does Elijah turn to Ahab and tell him that rain is coming, so the famine is going to be over. Remember, that's the thing that God told him to say at the beginning. Only after all that does he tell him that. He says, you go eat and drink and wait because this rain is coming. So Ahab goes to eat and drink and wait. And Elijah climbs the mountain to wait for the rain. And he waits and he waits and he keeps sending his messenger to go watch for rain. And eventually clouds start coming and the rain start coming. So Ahab heads home in his chariot. Elijah runs ahead of him to meet him at the place where he's going. But by the time they talk, you get to chapter 19. Ahab has already gotten there and told his wife Jezebel what has happened. In response to hearing that the prophets of Baal have been killed, Jezebel responds with this message to Elijah. She says, may the gods deal with me, be it ever so severely, if by this time tomorrow I don't make your life like one of them, like one of the prophets of Baal. It's like, you're going to be dead by this time tomorrow. And so Elijah runs for his life. He and a servant run away. Eventually they get to a town. He leaves his servant there and he runs into the wilderness, a full day's journey, just running. He finds himself under a small tree in the desert and begins to pray that he will just die there. He's so lost. He's so dejected, feeling like such a failure, feeling so alone that he just wants to die. Not even this great show of strength can get the king and queen to turn back to God. And in his sorrow, he collapses and falls asleep. Then you get to chapter 19. I'm going to read starting in verse 5. So they lay down under the tree and fell asleep. All at once, an angel touched him and said, get up and eat. He looked around and there by his head was some baked bread over hot coals and a jar of water. He ate and drank and then lay down again. The angel of the Lord came back a second time and touched him and said, get up and eat, for the journey is too much for you. So he got up and ate and drank. Strengthened by that food, he traveled 40 days and 40 nights until he reached Horeb, the mountain of God. There he went into a cave and spent the night. And the word of the Lord came to him. What are you doing here, Elijah? He replied, I have been very zealous for the Lord God Almighty. The Israelites have rejected your covenant, torn down your altars, and put your prophets to death with the sword. I am the only one left. Now they're trying to kill me too. The Lord said, go out and stand on the mountain in the presence of the Lord, for the Lord is about to pass by. Then a great and powerful wind tore the mountain apart and shattered the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. After the wind, there was an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. After the earthquake came a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. After the fire came a gentle whisper. When Elijah heard it, he pulled his cloak over his face and went out and stood at the mouth of the cave. Then a voice said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He replied, "I have been very zealous for the Lord God Almighty. The Israelites have rejected your covenant, torn down your altars, and put your prophets to death with the sword. I am the only one left, and now they're trying to kill me too." The Lord said to him, "Go back the way you came and go to the desert of Damascus. When you're there, anoint Hazael king over Aram. Also anoint Jehu, son of Nimshi, king over Israel. And anoint Elisha, son of Shaphat from Abel-Meholah, to succeed you as prophet. Jehu will put to death any who escape the sword of Hazael. Elisha will put to death any who escape the sword of Jehu. Yet I reserve 7,000 in Israel, all those whose knees have not bowed to Baal and whose mouths have not kissed him." So Elisha gets up and he goes and does this. There's a lot of ground in this story. But what I want to highlight is we're looking for God. We're looking for God's action in this story. You see, God actually only speaks a very small handful of times in this story. First place in this is when he tells him that he wants him to go and tell Ahab that it's going to rain. Previously, God had spoken to give him provision, but he says, "Okay, I want you to go tell Ahab that it's going to rain." The next time God speaks in this story is when the messenger of God says, "Wake up, you need to eat something." You notice that there's no record in this of God saying, "Okay, here's how I want you to play this showdown out." The closest we have is Elijah when he prays, like, "Let him know that I've done all this because you've told me to." But there's actually no record of God telling him to. It goes from, "Go tell Ahab that it's going to rain," to him asking God to take his life because he is so exhausted, so beat up, feels so helpless, so worthless. And God says, "Wake up and have something to eat." That's the next time you have God clearly speaking to him. The time after that is when he says, "Elijah, what are you doing here?" And Elijah gives his whole, like, "Oh, I'm all alone. I got nothing left. I'm the only one. I just want to die." He asks that question again through that still small voice. The Hebrew word there is actually the same word that gets used for silence. But how do you describe a silent voice other than to maybe use the language of whisper? It's this silent voice. God asking, "Okay, what's going on? Why are you here?" Just asking to listen to this man who is at the end of his rope. And the fourth time is when he responds, and he says, "Get up, go do your work, and while you do it, go anoint this other guy who's going to take over for you, because it's time for you to start looking to pass things on." Not in a critical way, in a way that says you're not alone, and things are going to keep happening even when you're not here. I'm doing something here. You're a part of it, but it's going to keep going when you have nothing left to give. So often, we want to be impressive. In our Instagram and Facebook world, we want to show just how amazing we are, have it put on display. Most of us are pretty thoughtful about what pictures we post online that's going to kind of put our good side forward and make people think we're great. It's very common in the church world to focus on big events and the big stuff and the big show. And it's also very common in the church world to plan the big show and then turn around and say, "Oh yeah, God, will you please bless this and make sure it goes really well?" Kind of like a big showdown with some prophets that only after it's all set up does he pray, "Oh God, could you make sure this happens so you can show yourself on display?" In Elijah's life, the big show, the big showdown, that's not the place where God reveals himself most significantly. Maybe most impressively to all the people. Maybe the most powerfully from what they think power should look like, but not the most significantly to Elijah. God spoke most clearly in the quiet messages, in the provision he gave, in the presence he offered, in his comfort of a weak and helpless man. That's where God really spoke. It's Mother's Day, and this story reveals a couple of things about God that I think are important for all of us to hear, but especially mothers. At the very beginning of the Bible, we read that God made humanity in his image. Male and female, he created them. Both men and women reflect God uniquely. God in the Bible is presented to us both with paternal attributes and maternal attributes. In this passage, the work of God, the providing, the protecting, the listening, the comforting, the being present, the stuff that that God is initiating, those are primarily maternal attributes. The stuff that God initiates in this story. In the shadow of this big show of strength and boldness, it's the maternal attributes where God is most clearly seen. I don't mean to pigeonhole or stereotype all women here, but I do want to say this, that the emphasis on care and provision and comfort and protection tends to be most beautifully on display through women. And women, whether you're a mother or not, when you act in ways that do this, emphasize care, emphasize provision and comfort and protection, and you act out of that maternal side of you, you are powerfully reflecting God to us in ways that we absolutely need to see and hear and celebrate, even though we sometimes don't emphasize those things. We need that perspective and we need that voice if we are going to see God fully in each other and if we're going to accurately reflect that reality of God to the world. On Mother's Day, you need to hear that when you act out of who you are reflecting God. Please keep it up. Please do it. And when those of us who are men may downplay some of those things, we are doing wrong, not you. Second thing that's here that I think is important to notice on Mother's Day is that you reflect God because that's how God postures himself. In this passage, God comes offering provision, protection, comfort, and presence. He shows up most significantly in ways that often seem insignificant. Like Elijah, we often want to emphasize the big thing, the big show, the big event, the big party, whatever it might be. Well, God didn't leave Elijah alone in the big moment. God was there. He responded to Elijah's prayer in that big moment. We have no record in the Bible that God orchestrated them. What God did orchestrate was Elijah getting the food and rest that he needed. Elijah recognizing the wind and the earthquake and the fire didn't reflect the heart of God's presence. Rather, the stillness and silence and gentleness and quietness did. Elijah discovered that he was not alone and would not be alone as he tried to follow God. Those are the things that God orchestrated. It's important that we recognize in our own lives God's presence in the mundane and the ordinary, even the boring circumstances of life. For parents, know that God is present in the making of lunches and the reading of bedtime stories, in listening to how the day went, in praying over your sleeping teenager, in laughing together, and in the desperation that comes when you're afraid because of the decisions your young adult is making. We may work to orchestrate special things. We may try and manipulate certain things, and God doesn't leave us alone in those times by any stretch of the imagination. But the real presence of God, the deep significance, is often found in the simple and often difficult realities of life. For all of us, God shows up in the meal that gets provided. In the faithfulness of a spouse as they care for their ill partner after 60 years of marriage, or after 1 year of marriage and a difficult diagnosis. God shows up in the comfort of sitting down for a cup of tea and a much needed conversation with a good friend. In the phone call or text we get from somebody who always seems to know exactly what to say. To anybody who's ever felt at the end of their rope, has been certain of their inability and inadequacy, or has ever felt completely alone. If we'll learn to stop chasing all of the great and fancy products or solutions that marketers or our friends or sometimes even churches will tell us will give our lives meaning and purpose, we may find ourselves at the place we're finally ready to meet with God and hear from Him as He tells you that you do have what it takes, that you're not alone, that you can keep going. In my experience, in talking with many who are mothers, there are a lot of moms who struggle with these feelings of inadequacy, of failure, of loneliness, of not being sure of anything that they have to offer. And what Elijah heard in this moment when God really met him is something that we need to hear. That God sees you in those moments. His heart breaks for you in those moments. He wants to hear from you, and He wants you to hear that you have what it takes, that you're not alone, you're not a failure, that He is with you. To anybody who's struggling, God longs to be in this with you and to help provide what you need. He may lead you forward in ways that don't fix all your problems, but He's still there with you, holding you close, to use a maternal image, kissing your wounds and helping you to heal. To women in particular, just want you to hear thank you for reflecting this reality of God to us well. We're going to close today by singing a song that reminds us of this, what God is communicating to us and communicating to Elijah through this story.